visitors. And what they say, the post has been a bit misleading. It's actually Brevo, Pigs, Canberra, Strathguinness and Dura Den. So I'm sorry about people who've come from Ceres, because the poster was put up there. But anyway, there's such a lot to know about Ceres that Yvonne said to come back and talk about Ceres
and Piscotty.
Piscotty another time. But it's really good to see you. I just want to say that to the people in the village that the last talk and supper raised £146 for the poor. That was pretty good. Now, some of you may remember our exhibition and display to mark the millennium, and it's hard to believe it was 6 years ago, and there's been a lot of new faces in the village since then, so Elaine brought a selection of photographs here from that exhibition on to see. So, when I was asked to arrange this talk, local history covering nearby villages, I wondered where to start, really, and I was always told when I was small, if you want to find anything out, go to the library. So I went to a library in Cooper, and there was Yvonne. So that was pretty good. And Yvonne's the information supervisor for Fife Council, based in the Cooper Library. Right, so there we are. So I think we'll hope to learn something about the other villages around here, and I'm sure it's going to be most interesting. And if anybody's got any pictures and things to share afterwards, we'll be delighted to see them. So please welcome Yvonne Boney.
I just want to start by saying I do apologise about the mix-up in the villages that I'm going to talk about tonight. However, those who come from Ceres alone I could spend an hour on. There is so much. So if the hall wants to invite me back in a few months, and I'll talk about Ceres, no problem. Blebo Craigs, Dura Den, Kenbach, Strathkinnis. A potted history. In the time that we've got tonight, you couldn't possibly do the full history of the four villages. That just would not be possible. Oh no, I'm too far away. Oh, could you pass me my mouse? I'm standing here because there's so many people. I'm actually trying to make sure everyone can see. Oh no, it's not working either. Right. First question of the night. Who's actually good with laptops? Because all I need you to do is press a button when I give you the wink, or the nod, or whatever.
That man can do that.
Yeah.
There we are.
Right. Yeah. Oh, radio.
Oh, well.
Right. Four villages, two parishes. It might seem strange when you look at the maps today, but Blebo Craigs, Dura Den and Kenbach are actually in Kenbach Parish. Strathkinnis is in St Andrews Parish, and that has made a difference. Certainly for the church history, that has made a large difference in how they've actually progressed over the centuries. The Ordnance Gazetteer of 1883 mentions Blebo as an estate, doesn't mention Blebo Craigs as only being the village. It actually has Blebo as an estate. So Blebo Craigs, while it was a village, wasn't considered important enough to actually have a mention all by itself. It was purely an estate with two villages. Dura Den is the small ravine famous for its fish fossils. Has anyone here actually seen the fish fossils? I know St Andrews University has some of them. Kenbach is the parish as well as the village, and it has the four large houses: Blebo House, Dura House, Kenbach House and Rumgally. Strathkinnis in the Ordnance Survey Gazetteer is actually not mentioned separately. It's only mentioned in the St Andrews parish listing, and unfortunately it has two lines, so it doesn't really give us much help at all. The spellings. Kenbachs have quite a few spellings over the years. The one that is probably the most romantic is Kemp Usher, the Field of Battle. There are no documented evidence anywhere that there was any battle fought in Kenbach of any size whatsoever, unless of course the Covenanters, they did do one or two bad things at the time, but there's actually no documented evidence of a battle. So the chances are that that is probably just a romantic tale, although it's a nice tale. The name it most probably comes from is Kem or Came, which is actually what we now know as the Ceres Burn. That's a modern name. It was the Came and it was actually known as the Came. So it's probably that it came from there. But there's no actual evidence exactly where the name came from. So whatever anyone decides is their choice, it's just as valid as anybody else's. Kennebec was actually the name used in 1244 when Bishop David de Burnham actually dedicated the church. So that is the oldest, so far as we know. There are documents that we haven't come across and haven't been deciphered. So at the moment, that's the oldest spelling that we have. That's not necessarily the correct one, as far as we're concerned. Can I give you the wink now for the next slide, please? The inhabitants. This is from 1791, and it's from the statistical account of 1791 to 1799, which was the first statistical account that was done. There were two more, but they gave different types of information. They actually broke the inhabitants down by the church you followed. So forget male and female or how well off you were. It was what religion you followed. Mostly was the established church, which if you think it's 1790, we are looking at Covenanters' time, we're looking at dissenters, we are going to come to the Reformation. Scotland at that time, the church history was, we were in schism, plain and simple. You had the Burgher Seceders, the anti-Burgher Seceders, the Presbytery of Relief, there was certainly quite a lot of Relief churches around. They tended to be more in towns as opposed to villages. You have Episcopalian, one poor soul. You have one poor Anabaptist and two Unitarians. One and one. But, you know, it's a total. 588. That was for the parish of Kennebec. There are very few figures breaking down some Strathkinness. And they're not particularly reliable because Strathkinness was lumped in with St Andrews, and it tends to be St Andrews is one figure which included everywhere around about. So unfortunately I can't give you that. There is a difference with Strathkinness, of course, in that at one point it was called a mean little village, which is a great shame because it's not mean at all. Church history. If you ever want me to come and talk about church history, I'll come and do a 5-hour talk, no problem. And I'll even wake you up at the end. Could I have the next slide, please? The Kennebec case. Has anyone heard of the Kennebec case? Well, it's had its fair share of churches, has Kennebec. The present building being the third, as far as we know. One never knows, there may have been one that hasn't been recorded. And that is the whole thing with local history, that most of what we say, we may say it with some authority, but what we're actually meaning is, as far as we know, because as we know, things are discovered every day that change our outlook on history. It's also had its fair share of controversy. In 1840, the United College of St Andrews appointed the Reverend George Cook as assistant and successor to the Reverend Dr MacDonald. And this was a report in the Fifeshire Journal, which was a local newspaper at the time, 13th of February 1840. It led swiftly, after that nice little entry in it, to what was then became known as the controversy of the Kennebec case. In 1847, the Patronage Act came into force, and that meant that places like the colleges, the churches, they actually lost the right to put ministers in all by themselves. And by churches, I don't mean the established church, I mean small groups within a church. It actually went back to being the presbytery who put the ministers in, who elected them and sent them in, which of course is maybe slightly different how we do it today, because you actually have to go and your congregation has to accept you. In those days, they didn't have to accept you, you just were there. In 1840, because United College of St Andrews, which is one of them was St Leonard's, actually said this is going to be this assistant and the successor, bearing in mind that Reverend MacDonald was actually still alive at this point in time, and they knew that the Act was going to be coming in, because in those days you didn't get Acts in 6 months that we can have now. It took years to get Acts through. the thought was that if the Reverend died after 1847, then the Reverend Cook had actually no right to automatically assume he was going to get the position. And there was an awful lot of toing and throwing. It actually became a little bit of on the legal side as well. And eventually, according to the FASTI, because the Reverend Cook disappeared, we don't actually know what happened to him, but in Hugh Scott's FASTI, James MacDonald continued until 1843, which of course is before 1847. He was 91 when he died, and in 1844 he was succeeded by a Thomas Andrew Alexander Easton, who himself died a year later. So the Reverend Cook did not become a minister officially. It's just all part of the church history at the time that everybody argued about everything, which is maybe not too different from the politics today, but maybe the church was the politics of yesterday. The Kenback case was important, but a lot of the arguments, when you actually read through the records, you actually labour to find the point, when all we were looking at was he going to be a minister afterwards or was he not? Nobody wanted to lose their power. And if I could have the next slide, please. Duradin. I actually, in our photographic collection in Cooper, have no photographs of Duradin, which is a great pity. And I'll be talking about a photographic collection at the end. However, Miller's Fife Pictorial and Historical actually has a lovely drawing. It really does show Duradin, you know, the water coming down a mill, which is exactly how we think of Duradin. Geographically, it's 3 kilometres long. Don't ask me to say that in miles, because it takes me forever to actually translate kilometres to miles. And it follows the course from Piscotty to Kenback, roughly. Serious Burn runs through it, which of course we know as the Serious Burn, but it's actually called the Kame. Originally it was called Kame. Nowadays, Duradin Wood is managed by the Woodland Trust. It was actually donated by a Mrs. Janet Francis in 1985. It's classed as a long-established off-plantation origin, a LEPO, which doesn't really mean anything. And unfortunately, even though it's actually been classed as a wildlife site as well, none of this is binding in law. Now, I do believe there are changes afoot to actually try and protect Duradin legally, and hopefully that happens, because we really don't want to lose it. It is a lovely place to be. Traditionally, the woods there were ash, hazel, oak, elm, beech and sycamore. I would imagine there's some Scots pine now there, because there usually is in the woodlands. It also has the Covenanter's Cave, and it has what may be the largest colony of soprano pipistrelle bats in Scotland. Now obviously that may change in the future, hopefully it doesn't. I would just suggest you don't go to the Covenanter's Cave in the dark, especially if you've got long hair. If I could have the next slide, please. I'm hoping that someone will be able to pronounce all these for me. And unfortunately, I forgot to bring my Mars bar for the person who did, but never mind. Duradin, whenever anyone thinks of Duradin, they think of fish fossils. They are very famous. The yellow sandstone in Duradin, where they're found, is part of the upper beds of the Old Red, which is just the part of the geology of the area. That area is about 300 to 400 feet thick, but the fossils are only found in a very thin layer of that. So I suppose we're actually quite lucky that they were near enough the surface to be found. They were excavated by the Reverend Dr. John Anderson. He was born and brought up in Newborough. He studied at St Andrews University and then finished his theological training in Edinburgh. He was eventually awarded by St Andrews University a Doctor of Divinity, which is quite nice. He was also an amateur geologist, which of course is how he came to be involved in this. He excavated for over 20 years in Duradin. So while some of the articles give the impression that he went, he found and he was gone, he actually went there for over 20 years finding these fish. He wrote many articles and books, one of which was the Monograph of Duradin, which we have in the library. Maybe we'll get my plug in for the library quite early on. We have that in the library. It's actually quite good. I mean, it is written in the style that they wrote in that time, but it is very interesting if you're interested in fossil fish. He has a lot of good information in it. In 1838, when literally the Philosophical Society of St Andrews was founded, he was actually its very first honorary member. So Duroden is remembered in that way. The society was actually very advanced for the time. It proposed as members Mr and Mrs Bain Dalgleish. The Bain Dalgleishes were actually the owners of the Dura estate at the time. It had been in the Bain family since approximately 1750. So Mr and Mrs Dalgleish also became honorary members. And in fact, that meant that Mrs Dalgleish became the first honorary member in 1861 of a society. A literary society. Now that's quite a claim to fame. In those days, women were just not members of these things, and to be an honorary member because of the fossil fish was very good. In 1858, which is actually not that long before he died, Reverend Anson wrote a lovely letter relating some of the happenings during one of his excavation days at Duroden. Does anyone want to try and pronounce these before I go on to the next slide?
No.
You won't mind if I don't pronounce them. Could I have the next slide, please? This is actually part of the letter. While they were seeking for fish, I set our party all over the den to see its beauties, which they all admired greatly. Lord Kinnaird and myself remained with the workmen. His lordship cast his coat, I kept mine on. Even in those days, even when they were excavating, presumably in nice weather, they still had an issue about keeping the coat on or taking the coat off. This went on at a snail's pace for an hour and a half, and no fish would appear. The party came back, and we all lunched on pies, chicken, pigeon and ham, and then grapes, peaches, plums, apricots and nectarines, all of which were washed down with plentiful supplies of cider and sherry. So while he's actually talking about his day's excavations, he isn't actually mentioning the fish very much. It's more important about the coat and his food. He then says, we heard a shout just as we were finishing from the diggers, and we all ran, some tumbling and falling by the way, and lo, a fish. I think we can tell he was a reverend. the largest and finest that ever rose to the geological hammer was laid at our astonished feet. He was definitely a minister. And lo, a fish. It is nice that we've actually got some record written by him that was a letter to a member of his family. And it's nice to see that he didn't just write these very serious articles, he actually wrote other things as well. Unfortunately, in 1864, the Reverend Anderson died in Nice while he was convalescing from a serious illness. If we can go on to the next one, please. An enormous water wheel. This is from the Fifeshire Journal in 1838. That's way at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. I mean, we are talking early here. And Kenbach actually had a claim to fame in its mill when Mr. William Yule was actually building it. He put in an enormous water wheel. Now, that may not be everyone's idea of a claim to fame, but at that time it was quite a decent thing. I won't read it all out. It's not particularly well readable, but it is a very old paper. I mean, this is what, 170 years old. So it's a very old newspaper, and it's actually on microfilm. The originals are through in Edinburgh. It's actually, the dimensions were as follows. This is about halfway down. Total diameter, 89 feet. Breadth across, 10 feet. Depth of bucket, 20 inches. It was partly framed with cast, partly with malleable iron, and its buckets were made of wood. They actually go on in the article to list the three other largest water wheels in Scotland. One was in Ayrshire, and two were in Perthshire. However, these large wheels were actually made up of wheels within wheels, and this one was actually one that stood by itself. So while it didn't pretend to be the largest, it was only 8 feet in diameter less I'm the second biggest. And it was actually not just one wheel, it was a wheel within wheel. So it was a very large, substantial water wheel. In 1838, the reason he put it that there was because he was actually kitting out his spinning mill at the time in Duraden. He's putting in machinery. Well, it does tell you actually who made the water wheel, sorry. It was an Umberston and Kerr of Dundee. So it didn't come very far, but far enough. If I could have the next slide, please. We have here an 1894 map, the Ordnance Survey map. If anyone actually wants to see these maps, we have almost a complete collection for North East Fife in Cooper Library. You come and ask a member of staff and we'll go and get them for you. The maps are very large. We were talking about a size AO. They are really huge maps. And I've just taken a very, very small part, which actually shows Dura House in the middle and how close it actually was to the Bible Works. Not actually that far away. I'm quite sure that if the mill was going full guns, people in Bible House would probably have been able to hear it. And certainly the water wheel would have made a fair amount of noise. So I'm quite sure the people in Dura House did actually hear this. We don't have any pictures in the library of Dura House, so unfortunately I wasn't able to bring one of those. But it was a mid-1700s layered house, which had a baronial style extension added in 1861 by an architect called John Milne. He actually built and added to many of the buildings in Fife. He was involved in Kinburn House in St Andrews, Lothocker House and Daresley Parish School, but he was involved in hundreds of buildings in Fife. Sometimes it's quite interesting following the trail of the architect as well as people who live there, because you do tend to find lots of connections. Could I have the next slide, please? This is my one solitary picture of Bleibel Craigs. Can we actually pinpoint where it is? It's the corner. Yeah. Has it changed much? Is there additions, subtractions?
No,
many changes?
Yes.
Not
yeah.
A little bit.
Yeah.
I mean, buildings have tended to be looked after more than they were possibly when this was taken. This postcard actually doesn't have any date on it, which is a pity. In the late 1700s, around about the Mire town of Bleibel, there was actually a discovery made of a rich vein of lead ore. I'm going to say Mr. John Betton. Now, I've actually found three books who all have different pronunciations of the name. Now, Betton is what I would consider probably the one that is to be used. There are two other publications that we have in Cooper Library that actually have it pronounced different. But that again is what happens with local history. Names, the spelling and the pronunciation changes over the centuries. Beaton is how we would pronounce it today. How the book pronounced it that actually had this particular information in it was Betton. And that was how they actually pronounced it, and it was Betton. I hadn't heard of Betton before. The third pronunciation that I came across was in a very old book, and it was Bethune, and it actually had the un in it. But she's right. Is there any of the family here that can tell me which is the correct one for today?
There were cadet families, the Beatons of Wales.
Yeah. But there seems to be this three different pronunciations. But that's what happens with family history. There's no fixed way of actually saying or saying that things are how they are. Mr. John Beaton and some of his friends actually formed a company, and they mined the ore, they sold it, and they also hunted for other minerals that were on the Bleibel lands. Don't think they were particularly successful in finding anything else. Whether they looked hard enough, well, they were young men of their time. Also in the late 1700s, the Poor Fund, which was in very, very dire straits, was left a legacy by Mrs. Margaret Beaton. She left £50. Now, in the late 1700s, that was a lot of money. And what the trustees of the Poor Fund did, they actually distributed £20 of it to the poor of the area of Rebel Craigs, and the other 30 they put into trust. And that trust actually lasted many decades. The £30 lasted a long time because they were very wise men and they made lots of nice investments. So it was a very substantial amount of money for that time. In Rebel Craigs in 1862, there are actually very faint records, there's not a lot of information on two schools. There was an adventure school which was run by a Thomas Thompson, who I could find out no information about at all. He seems to have come in, ran school and went away again, and it only seemed to run for 2 or 3 years, which is about right. Cooper has an adventure school which again only ran for 4 years, and it was in the 1860s, so it's very much a time that when they say adventure school, it's basically almost anything except reading, writing and arithmetic. They did crafts, they did business related things, they even did things like they would take away camping and things, but they didn't do reading, writing and arithmetic. Very strange, but never mind. There was also a female industrial school which of course did all the feminine crafts of the time, your knitting, your sewing, your lace making, even cooking, cleaning, all that type of thing, how to make a bed, everything. They did, these industrial schools did absolutely everything, because they weren't just aimed at the well-off women, they were actually aimed at the very poor women who could afford to spend this penny a week to actually go to these schools. There's a misconception that the industrial schools were for a certain class, and they weren't. They weren't all for that. There were some who were, but they weren't all for that. They actually tried to teach all different classes of women how they should be behaving in their particular class. Not something for today's market, that's for sure. Can I have the next slide, please? Rebel Craigs had actually quite a few clubs in the 1800s. It was a very, very socially advanced place. One of these was the Coiting Club. And it was played here on Mr. Harris's ground on Saturday afternoon between six members of Lucas and a similar number from Rebel Craigs. The match occupied 3 hours. That's a fair length of time for a quitting match. And then refreshments were partaken of in the railway inn, and a pleasant hour or two was spent. Yes. there was quite a few clubs. There was cricket was something that we maybe don't associate quite so much with Scotland, but in the 1800s most little villages and towns had their own cricket clubs. Nowadays there aren't that many who have cricket clubs, maybe bowling and football's taken over, but cricket was very, very popular in the 1800s. If I could have the next one, please, that was quite a quick one. Bible House. Again, I don't have a picture of Rebel House in our own collection, but was able to go to Dundee Central Library, and they have a nice little website they've just set up called Photoopolis, which actually has a lot of Fife photographs on it. I got this nice one of Rebel House. Yes, yeah, surely.
It's not Rebel House.
That's actually Grove House.
It's Grove House. Yeah,
Grove House.
Yeah, that's
Grove
House. Oh. We've emailed the Dundee Central Library a few times about that, and they've still not changed it.
They've still not changed it. Well, I do apologise then. I do apologise. So, can you tell us anything about Grove House then?
That's where the back is.
Grove House was on Bidwell Estate.
Right.
It's called about stolen in 1952.
Mm-hmm.
So that's settling up at the Clever House.
Right. Right. I mean, it's certainly something I didn't have a photograph of Bible House in the collection, and I've only got a very faint description of it. Looked at that, it seemed to fit the description, so I do apologise for putting the wrong picture up. However, I shall get on to Dundee Central Library.
That's Bible House.
That's Bible House. Oh, dearie me. However, you learn something new every day, and I have discovered in this life that you certainly do. However, I will talk about the real Bible House. It's built in the 1800s. In 1903, an architect called James Finlay was involved in the back wing being added and the round northeast entrance tower being added. He was based mainly in Dundee and had done very little. He only did a couple of things in Fife, so I'm assuming there must have been some sort of family connection, although I couldn't actually trace the family connection when I was looking for him actually to come across into Fife and do anything. He tended to go from Dundee, Carnoustie and up the way. He just did very little in Fife. About the only thing he did do in Fife, he added to the Blythe Memorial Hall in Newport, and strangely enough did the additions to the Garbridge Cooperative Baking Society. Why he did that, I really don't know. And it does seem as though, because it has happened, I've seen it before, that there might actually be some sort of family connection, even if it is quite way out for him to actually come and do one of the only three items that he did in Fife, because it is quite unusual. Because even the rest of his firm did nothing in Fife, because I traced his firm as well, and they just never came to Fife at all. That's a bit of a mystery, I'm afraid. So we'll rapidly go on from that picture, which is totally wrong. Blebo Mill. This was actually done by pupils of Del Baxter. About 10 years ago they did an industrial project, which I think is excellent to actually get the kids involved in looking at the industrial heritage of the area. And this is a map that they had drawn, and it's so good that I decided that I would actually use it. And we have used it before. There's not much left of most of the mills nowadays, and probably less and less as the years go by. Blebo Mill virtually disappeared. I dare say there are some remnants if you look hard enough, but to all intents and purposes, there's very little left. Blebo Mill itself had actually iron-faced doors. Whether that was to keep you in or keep you out, I don't know. The powerhouse was round back, which the powerhouse itself appears to have had more than one floor. Blebo Mill obviously would be a tall mill, as they all were. The powerhouse. Sorry?
Where is it?
Fred, I was on the map earlier on for Tura House. Blebo Mill was literally just across the field, right on the Cairn Burn.
Right.
Yeah, it's very close, but I say there's hardly any of it left to actually see. You might have to go and hunt about for the odd stone.
Is that the house that
men
breakfast these days?
Oh, right.
Mm-hmm. But there's very little.
Very little left. I mean, if you hunt about, you might find the odd remnant, but there's almost nothing to see, unfortunately. It's a great shame.
Presumably the weir was constructed for the,
yeah,
for the water.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they tended to use natural occurring maybe slopes or whatever to try and actually make a weir much easier to do. They tended to try and position them in a place that they could actually put a water wheel in and it would be able to use without too much problems. So chances are that there was some sort of slight fall in the ground as the river came down or something for them to actually have put the mill there. But unfortunately, with there being very little left, it's quite difficult to actually work out exactly why they did put it there. There's actually in one of the maps we're going to see in a few slides, it actually shows you the gasometer which was put in there. And in fact, it was only in 1970 that the last gas standard was removed. Now I'm assuming that it wasn't actually in use up to that time, but certainly it was only 1970 it was removed. And in a way that's a great pity, because it would have been quite nice to have actually had it still there, even if it was all disconnected and made safe and such. It would have been quite nice to have seen it. There are still some remnants of the water control system where the weir is. Not a lot, and whether you could actually look at it and without exactly knowing what you were looking at be able to work out exactly how it worked is probably doubtful, but there are some small remains. And it's a pity that the industrial heritage wasn't seen as something that we could actually keep, because a lot of these mills are quite unique in the position that they're in. The mills at Blebo, there was a barley mill, a flax mill and a flax spinning mill. Further along there was actually the Yule Field Mill. We talked about William Yule earlier on with his water wheel. It has pretty much disappeared because a lot of the stone from the Yule Field Mill was actually taken into St Andrews and used for quite a lot of the buildings in and around St Andrews. So at least we were reusing the stone, if nothing else. If you want to go on to the next one, please. I have two little articles here. The top one is Miller Lands for Sale in Fife. Now this is actually a piece of ground off the lands of Blebo lying betwixt the two corn mills. So you had the rector there on us, possessed by Mr. Johnson, and you had Mr. Yule on the other side. But it states quite clearly, the property has the same command of water. And of course, if you had a mill and you had a water wheel, you needed water. So you had the same command of water as Mr. Yule had in his mill. And I suppose that was very, very important. There was no point in buying a mill and finding that you actually had no control and no access to the water, because you couldn't then work. It actually says, and in the hands of a capitalist may be turned to good account. Oh, dear me. Then talks about the Dearsey station being close at hand of the Edinburgh, Perth and Dundee Railway, which is very true. Dearsey isn't that far away, and certainly the station there at that time. That was in 1850. The bottom one was one I found. I actually found rather a lot of these, and I only actually brought one with me, was to let furnish the mansion house of Kenbach. It was slightly out of order, but that's just because it's on this particular slide. Kenbach House seems to have been let out rather a lot. Throughout a goodly part of the 1800s, it seems to have been let out, which is a great shame. Oh, sorry. Playing, told off. The highest offer, or any offer, may not be accepted. Presumably then, it wasn't just the offer that was important, it was who you were and what you were going to do when you actually went to live there. But I did find about 8 of these spread out over about a 50-year period. So it seems a great shame that the house had been literally left by the family. But these things do happen. If you want to go on to the next slide, please. This actually shows about Blaibow Works. We can just see the Blaibow House. This is it now, further across the way. You can just see Dura House, and then Blaibow Works is up there. And one of the buildings that you see is quite close to the drawing that the Belbaxter Peoples made. And considering this is 1894, and the Belbaxter Peoples did their drawing about 10 years ago, so I think they did quite well. It then comes across, and we have Blaibow Quarry, which is on the right hand side as you're looking at it. Fife has its fair share of quarries. It also has its fair share of coal mines. Most of them, with a few exceptions, were not deep. Certainly the coal mines, and there are hundreds in northeast Fife, were very shallow. You tended to maybe only go up to 20 feet below ground. A few men would get together, they found a seam of coal, they would go in just underneath the ground, mine it out, and then close their company and move on to the next area. Obviously it's a bit more difficult than I'm saying, because you've still got to put all the structures in, but there weren't mines as we have long on it in the west part of Fife. They were very small mines. Our quarries tend to be quite small, as we would look at quarries today. We're used to the quarries where you stand at the top and the huge dumper truck is this little matchbox at the bottom. They weren't like that in this area. They were relatively shallow compared to what we're used to now today. We had quite a few quarries in northeast Fife, Blaibow Quarry being one of them. Mostly it was limestone and sandstone. You may have found some other things occasionally, but in the main it was limestone and sandstone. In this particular map, now that we're more central, you can actually see the gasometer, which actually has just above where Blaibow Works is. If you go up the three big trees that are written, and you actually see gasometer. So in 1894 there was the gasometer is marked there. I would pretty much say that unless you were in a helicopter and maybe could actually see some sort of imprint, that there will be nothing there now. I would very much doubt that you'd be able to make it out at all. Go on to the next slide, please. Strathkinnis from Magus Muir. These two postcards are separated by about 20 years. It's very obvious that you're looking at the same view from not quite the same position, but almost the same position. But there are quite a lot of changes. In the bottom one, you actually have a road sign. You have a nice new building, which is just to the right of the road sign. So there are changes in only 20 years. Now, these are both post 1900. I don't have any postcards in Cooper that are pre 1900 for Strathkinnis, both, but they are about 20 years separately. And I know this because one has a divider down the back and one doesn't. The ones that have a divider tend to be post 1920. The ones that don't are pre 1920, but there are exceptions to the rule. There are always exceptions to every rule. So there are differences. Has it changed much now from that particular view? Is it more built up?
Much more built up.
Is there anything in either of them that actually isn't there now? I mean, we always see houses more built up. Is there anything that isn't actually there from that particular view?
The junction has been staggered to prevent people flipping along that road.
Right. Right.
No, it's not staggered.
No,
what they've done is put up
blinding walls of plastic. It's up the right-hand side. This right-hand side here, the whole line of plastic as you come down the hill.
You're at the next one. You're at the top one.
The top one up at Claremont.
Strathkinnis has a slightly different history from Liblecaig's Kenbach and Duraden because it was in a different parish. It was in St Andrew's Parish. It stayed in St Andrew's Parish. In fact, it technically still is St Andrew's Parish, but in 1860 it became a quad sacra parish. Now, all that really means is that the church was actually forward thinking, looked at it, knew that the people of Strathkinnis, because Strathkinnis was growing, couldn't walk into St Andrew's to the nearest established church. Also, there was now getting too many people, and St Andrew's had too many people, and they weren't just going to sort of willy-nilly start building churches. So Strathkinnis Church became its own quad sacra parish. It became a parish in its own right, but legally was still of St Andrew's Parish. To actually change a parish legally took decades, and the church knew that they didn't have time to do that. Things had to be done. Strathkinnis was growing, St Andrew's was growing. They needed two churches, they needed two ministers, and not just a first and a second charge as you had in Cooper, but actually two separate areas. And so they made it a church parish, a quad sacra, part of but distinct in its own right. One of the other ones that's quite well known is actually Fruchie in Falkland. It's actually Falkland Parish, but Fruchie is a quad sacra parish in Falkland. In Strathkinnis quad sacra parish, you actually have also a very small area of Largo Ward as well, which is quite unusual to actually have travelled so far. But that's the way the church did it at the time. Magus Muir, of course, very famous. I'm sure everybody knows Archbishop Sharp. He was in a carriage with his daughter on his way to St Andrew's. The carriage was stopped by Covenanters, who actually went looking for him. They were looking for somebody else. They hauled him out and they murdered him. If anyone actually wants to have a look at a gravestone, if you go into Cooper Old Parish Churchyard, there's actually a gravestone to a David Haxton of the Fillet. There is a belief that Haxton wasn't actually completely involved in the murder of Archbishop Sharp, but he was hung on and quartered almost, since his body parts were sent all over Scotland, even though he didn't really strike the knife. But the gravestone is somewhat gruesome in that it has hands on it, because they're actually only hands of one of the Covenanters in it. So it's a bit gruesome. But it's well worth going to see. It may be a very old gravestone, but you can actually read it all and see all the images on it very clearly. Lovely gravestone to see. If I could have the next slide, please. The youth house in Strathkinnis. I could find nothing in anything I had in Cooper Library, and I was hoping someone here might be able to tell me about the youth house in Strathkinnis.
It was built by Mrs. Young as a youth club, I suppose.
Right.
Designed by Paul Waterhouse.
Mm. Even in the early valuation rules, it's not really listed separately. There's in the census records, there's mention of it. I could not find anything at all, but I had a postcard. I even went to the stage of going on the internet, and I had nothing there either. But that was my last resort. So that's fine. Now I've got a starting point. I'll actually try and find out more about
it. A little book written on partly the history of Strathkenneth.
Uh-huh.
But I'm sure it's got things to do with
that. Right. I've got two Strathkenneth books. I've got her book, and I couldn't find a mention of it. I couldn't know. I mean, I did speed read, but I was picking out the particular names I was looking for. And I have Mrs. Seed's book, and I have a book by a J. Duncan. Do we have a J. Duncan in the room? No. He wrote a Recollections of Strathkenneth. It's a lovely book as well. I mean, both are excellent books about Strathkenneth. And I've got another plug in for the library, and then we do have them, and you can come in and have a read of them. They're really, really good. I just couldn't find anything about it. So I thought I'd have the youth house up on the screen and actually talk about Strathkenneth School. It was substantially built in 1902 with plans from the architect David Henry. He was a partner in the St Andrews firm Hall and Henry, and their firm did mostly St Andrews buildings. He's actually probably more famous for the renovations he did to the Whey Part Inn, which is mostly as you see it today, is the renovations with a few minor alterations that he actually did. He also did the Gibson Hospital just across the road from the Whey Part. So he's quite well known in the area. He did lots and lots of St Andrews buildings. Didn't come out very much off St Andrews. Maybe came to Strathkenneth, he did one or two in Garbridge, but he didn't really come out very much. So it was maybe quite rare for him to actually come out and do the substantial part of Strathkenneth School. He also did a few of the three churches. Did quite a few of the three churches. He went from being established church to free church himself, and then went back to established church as all the churches changed in Scotland. But about in the early 1900s, a lot of the churches actually came back to the Church of Scotland that had separated during the Covenanters and the dissenters in the Reformation time. Let's see, I'll come and talk to you 5 hours on church history, not a problem. Could I have the next slide, please? Map of Strathkenneth. Now again, this is in 1894. There are 1855 maps available, but unfortunately in Cooper Library we don't have very many of them. I don't have a Strathkenneth one. From 1894 onwards we have pretty much a complete collection. In fact, it's only a few weeks ago I got the whole of the 1914 Ordnance Survey maps to get one, because they wouldn't let me take the one. I had to take the whole 210. So I took the 210, took the one out, and the rest will go down to the archive centre in Mark Inch. So they won't be wasted, but it's very difficult to actually get the old Ordnance Survey maps. We have church manse, we have free church manse, allotment gardens, are they still there or have they been built on now? The allotment gardens?
It's farmland.
It's farmland now?
Where?
I'm not sure how close I can go, because I'm tied here. I'm connected. The allotment gardens are down in the bottom left hand corner here. Yeah.
Planning permission for 300 houses there 20 years ago.
Oh dear! Never came to.
Because of the utilities, drainage, water, and electricity couldn't stand it.
So there's not allotments now in Strathkenneth. Oh, that's a pity. There's actually a little known Scottish, now this is a bit of an aside, but a little known Scottish Act which actually states that if three people who live in three separate houses in one street ask the council at the time for an allotment, the council is actually obliged to find land for them. And not a lot of people know that. Trouble is actually nowadays finding three separate houses in one street. It can't be in the village, it has to be in a street. But where they would find a lot of now. But it's a pity that they're gone. Certainly in 1894 you had allotment gardens. Most villages had some form of allotment system. and most of them actually by this time have disappeared, which is a great shame, but Stradkin still had them, which was nice. And actually, it actually goes the full length from the road all the way down and it, way off the area of the map that I just put on the slide. So it was a huge allotment area. Probably you're looking at maybe every single house had the allotment area. We have a Free Church Marsh, which is just across to the right where the allotment gardens are. If your eye travels across to the right, if you go all the way further across, you have a Lady's Well. Again, I wasn't able to find out much information about the Lady's Well. Is it still there? Does anyone know? Anybody know about the Lady's Well? It's quite interesting to look at these old maps, and I certainly could spend hours, because you actually see sometimes how long gardens used to be, and you now look at a house today and it has no garden at all, or it has a couple of feet at the back door. And in 1894, I mean, most of the houses here had very long gardens. And then when you think that they also had this huge amount of allotment gardens, people obviously grew an awful lot of stuff. Always long gardens, always allotment gardens. Certainly again, I mean, if you want to have a look at these maps in greater detail, and I've only got a very small portion of these maps on the screen, simply because they are so big, and if I made them smaller, you wouldn't really be able to read anything at all, so I had to pick out bits that looked a little more interesting. Around the start of the 1800s was when Stradkinnis started to blossom. As I said at the beginning, before that, it had been described as a mean little village. Probably more a hamlet at the time. But at the start of the 1800s, we were starting to see, certainly in 1838, William Yule was building his mill in Glebo, and people were starting to come back to the area that was left earlier on. Churches were being built, populations were being increased, and of course by 1860 we had the Quad Sacre Parish. There was work in the mills, there was work in the quarries, handloom weaving, which is something that's actually in the whole of North East Fife, as opposed to the rest of Fife, which is, it was mainly industrial weaving. We had an awful handloom weaving. By the 1900s, most of these things were dying out or had already gone. Handloom weaving was superseded by wonderful fast machines that put all the women out of work, which is a great shame. Then we come, of course, to the present. I would imagine there's not really much in any of the villages. Most of them are probably going to have to travel to get back. If I can come to the last slide, and this is where I have a favour. I have a picture of Stradkinnis Country Dancing Team, 1947-48. Unfortunately, the only thing I have with this, and I'll read it out, is a remark that was given in a competition which they entered in that year, but I don't know the name of the competition. They had a score of 86 and were placed third, so I think that's not too bad. The remarks given were, rather shy entry, never mind the spectators, think of the enjoyment you are going to get out of it. Set was well spaced and start was good. Two people here have a floating arm. Look out for this. Finish all your steps, especially when you are turning into line. The process was right till nearly the end when someone got onto the wrong foot. Try to stand very erect when not dancing. The phrasing and general rhythm were good, but the team got a little harassed towards the end. This will be easily corrected. The team is self-conscious, so didn't show the spirit that they could show, yet some started by looking so happy. My advice to this team is, lift up your chins a little and let yourself go. You are going to be good. And in the remark he has good in capital letters. Best wishes, MMD. We have nothing as to what the MMD stands for. The other part of this particular slide is, I have no names or even where the picture was actually taken. If we actually look at some of the people in the picture, especially the two young men on the bottom row, I think they look very young. And because we're looking at 1947, I think it's possible some of them might still be alive today. I've got a few copies of this, just ordinary plain paper copies, If anyone's interested, if they could take away with them. That's a good idea. That's a good idea.
There are quite a number of my colleagues in dance, especially the women. Well, we've done
if there is anybody still alive who's actually in this photo, and I'm sure that there's a good chance it might be, if they want to approach me, and I've got cards here tonight, then I would love to actually give them a proper photographic copy of this, and I would love to actually do it in such a way as to get the photo into the newspapers. It would be really nice to actually be able to put some names, actually be able to have someone that was in the photo. So the two young men at the front, I reckon are going to be late teens, early 20s, although I know it isn't very easy sometimes to age people from this type of photograph, which means that they could well still be alive today. Maybe some of the older ladies, possibly not, they're in their 30s and 40s, looking at a very old lady now. But I think some of these might be alive. Is there anyone here from Swiftkinnis tonight?
Yes.
Can I get you to take one away? Anyone who's here from Swiftkinnis or who knows people and knows about people in Swiftkinnis, and take a card of mine as well. I would love to know more about this picture. And which competition they went into to get stamped. And that was really good. They were obviously quite a young team at the time, because the way that the person who judged it is talking is that you are going to be good. You know, you've got a few good things to correct, but you're going to be good. So they were obviously relatively young team at the time. So I shall hand them out, and hopefully just someone give me a phone, please, if we do have someone who's still alive.
David Gibb might be able to tell the high road. He plays the accordion.
Even just to get some names. It may be that there's someone else still in the area, you know, moved away, and there's certainly not some generation that moves quite a lot. But if I could just find out some names, some details, even if anyone recognises what's in the background, I thought, well, that could be the competition that we're in. Just any information, and if there is someone who's still alive, then I'd love to give them a copy of it. Actually, the last copy I did was in Cooper Parish Church, and I had a photo from the 1920s. And it was off a group of school children, and after I turned away, so it was at the end of the talk, and suddenly we heard this, I'm here, and the lady was actually in the hall at the time, and that's me, and that's my friend who I see on Wednesday afternoon. And it was wonderful. You know, the lady's in her 90s now, and it was wonderful. She was so excited, and we got a nice photographic copy, and she went away very, very happy. So I would love to do the same thing, and maybe get a little photo in the paper. I suspect it was my posterity that, you know, sort of all these years later, 60 years later, there it is. You've got your photo, and your paper as well. Well, that's my talk finished. I say I do apologise for not having tears in this party. A bunch of people have come here to Scotty, but ask me back again, and I will gladly talk for an hour on the series at Scotty. And if you want church for 5 hours, I'll come and do that as well. So thank you very much. You've been very nice, even though I did get one slide completely wrong. I shall speak to Dundee about that in most serious terms. And thank you. And please come to the library. We have all this there. With the exception of the Glenbow High School. Thank you.
Would anybody like to ask any questions for them? I don't know.
No, there were a few different variations, but it's like Kemmer. There's a few romantic stories. It doesn't appear to be an exact definitive answer, which is the same for most police names. There are no definitive answers because they've changed spelling over the centuries. They've come and gone, depends how people have pronounced it. Today we have dictionaries that if we don't know a word, we don't have a dictionary in that now, right now. when you go back, if they wrote it the way someone spoke it, which depended on your accent or how old you were. There's no difference in that, I'm saying. If you want to come into the library, you can. Well, certainly the level in the gardens here is called just level and state with two villages. So the chances are that most of them were built by the estate owners or the workers on the estate. Yeah.
I have read that the flabber originated in Pict language, and it was meaning a meal bag.
That's
and
the
it suggested
point.
That...
there is a little book here that was produced in 1984, and there's a number of copies of this which are there, so we still need some Robin Gets brought in the room, which I just always went pound for the whole thing. So there are a number of these little books there. So if anybody would like one, they're available, and they're quite interesting about the village. So do take one if you'd like to have one. And we've got some photographs here of the village that were put together by Elaine Simonelli, which you might find some of these are interesting.
Oh, yeah.
We'll put one film to some of
Well, could I just say that little booklet is the text of a talk given by Dr. Ronald Kant in the 80s, I think.
Yes.
Some of you will probably know Ronald Kant or know him. It's a very authoritative account, and he does discuss the name Blebber, but I've forgotten how much.
The articles written on actually Roman remains in both this past site. We all think that Roman stopped at Hadrian's Wall. They didn't. They actually came up and into Fife. Maybe they didn't go much further north than Fife, but they did come here. So, yes, Pictish, because we do have a small amount of Roman remains here as well. We have standing stones, we have Pictish stones. Sir Biggo has a nice Pictish stone. So it's very possible. But that's the whole thing about Roman history, that there are very few definitive advances. Especially for very early, and certainly for names, very few definitive answers. We can only say, we think, probably.
Right. Okay. Well, thank you very much. So I hope you'll just stay around and have a cup of tea and chat and look at the pictures and talk to people and perhaps find out a bit more about others. Thank you very much.